Hey, it's Jen Hatmaker. Here's what I've learned in midlife. Joy isn't the reward you earn after all the work is done. Joy is the work. That's what this new series on For the Love is all about. The sacred, yes. It's choosing delight, rest, and pleasure on purpose. Because saying yes to yourself, that's the thing that finally lets you fill your table with everybody else. Come find your sacred yes with me. Follow and listen to For the Love wherever you get your podcasts.
Here we are on the Okranor Jewelers Talking Text Line. We find Robert Twilley, a professor of oceanography. How many times is that? The seventh time today that I've said professor.
A little credit.
It's the sound in ocean that's got me screwed up. Robert Twilley is a professor of oceanography and coastal sciences, and the interim vice president of research and economic development at LSU. Professor, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
We're starting out with kind of a rare bit of good news today about Louisiana's coastline. It's not all disappearing. Out in the Atchafalaya Basin, there's a place called Wax Lake Delta, which is kind of a happy accident, where nature is doing what decades of planning have not really been able to do. It's building new land. Doctor, tell us about what's happening at Wax Lake.
Well, you know, it's a perfect example of what the river can do. I mean, the power of the river is pretty exciting to see when you go down to that area. The Atchafalaya River, you know, is part of the Red River, and now it gets through the old river control structure, gets 30% of the flow, of the combined flow of the Red River and the Mississippi River. That comes down the Atchafalaya, so there's a delta building at the mouth of the Atchafalaya River. And then there's a flood control structure that was built that's called Wax Lake. Around Wax Lake, it's called the Wax Lake Outlet. And that outlet was for flood control for Morgan City, so that the Atchafalaya would not flood Morgan City. And at the mouth of the outlet, there's been a delta growing since 1974. And it's a perfect field site to look at what the river can do to build land in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if Wax Lake is sort of a happy accident, what should we be doing on purpose?
Well, I think the foundation of the Coastal Master Plan, and you go back to the 80s when we were building, what we thought would be the way to stop the hemorrhaging of our wetlands and the loss of our coastal landscape, the Atchafalaya and that region was considered to be the solution. We have to put sediment from the river back into these basins, or they're just going to continue to deteriorate. The key is that you have to have new sediment. You just can't dredge up sediment and put it in different places. That's robbing Peter to pay Paul, right?
Right.
That's a zero sum game. You got to have new sediment, and it was finding a way to put that sediment from the river. It's not like we're looking for the resource, right? It's passing New Orleans and passing Baton Rouge every day. Mm-hmm. It's flowing right by us. So how do we put it to use has been the tricky part, and understanding how much it takes and how much a certain amount of sediment will build a certain amount of land. That's the beauty of Wax Lake, because you can start to calibrate, you know, solutions relative to what you're trying to, the kind of outcomes and wetlands that you're trying to build.
Mm-hmm. This is probably not the most sophisticated question that we're going to have today, but it's just kind of coming to me now, and I figure, well, why not ask it? There's no way that we could just like scoop the sediment out of the river while it's floating by, right? You know what I mean? Like, saying, this is kind of a fantastical idea, but a giant sieve or something.
Well, you know, there is a concept. I mean, you know, we dredge more river sediment in the New Orleans area south of the river from New Orleans than any other place in the nation, right? And there's always been this concept of, and what we do is we pick up that sediment for, you know, to deepen the channel for shipping, mm-hmm. and then we place it farther offshore. And there's always been this idea of, well, gee, can't we beneficially use that sediment rather than just moving it offshore, like piping it from the dredges into wetlands. And we've done that. There are some fantastic projects in the lower river. But still, on the scale of what we're losing, that has always been the problem, is finding solutions that's proportional to the scale of what we're losing. Mm-hmm. And the pipeline does a great job, and we have the beneficial use of those sediments, but it's just not enough. And that's been the dilemma, is finding a solution. And so using diversions that divert the river into these basins, and that's really what the Old River control structure, that's what it is.
Right.
It's a diversion, yeah. Right, that's moving water down in the Chaffly, and we can see what it does in that area.
Yeah, I guess what I was kind of describing is effectively dredging, but I guess I'm just imagining like a permanent structure that allows sediment to kind of pile up, and then we can pipe it out from there without having to bring barges back and forth. But I don't know, maybe that's probably not a realistic solution.
Well, there's been a lot of looking at a variety of solutions.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that always is a critical piece in the formula is what's called the cost benefit analysis. Mm. And so you got to look at the benefits relative to the cost, and that becomes the real deciding factor. And so again, with diversions, it has that cost benefit ratio that actually works, because you're building a feature that lets the river flow through without using pumps, without using dredges, you're letting gravity basically do the work, and that's for free. And so once you build the concrete structure, then the operation and maintenance, there's no fuel. Right. There's no gap. There's very little operation and maintenance to it once you build it. Now, there's expenses there. The construction of these features are expensive, but once you build them, the operation and maintenance is really what makes it really effective.
What do you think is a sort of broader strategy for how to bring stakeholders to the table and kind of do harm reduction here? Because every time a solution is proposed, there's an organization or a community that rightly kind of pops up and says, hey, this is going to put us out of business, or this is going to flood my land, or, you know, what is the right way to sort of bring everybody to the table and say, not everybody is going to get what they want here, and the harm is going to be greater for some people than others, but in the grand scope of what we're trying to do, that's just what the cost is. How do you get people to be comfortable with being the ones paying the cost?
Right. No, you've nailed it. I mean, that's we're not into the technology is there. It's getting us to move forward is exactly what you just described. And I will tell you that first of all, you got to get them at the table. That's the first part. Everyone has to have a sense of trust around the table. That's a very hard part. You know, what information are we going to use? Do we trust the information? Do we trust, what we're using to justify the different schemes that are types of solutions that we're going to consider? And I think with diversions, and this is, this is my professional opinion, it's not the opinion of LSU, but I've always advocated, and the science community knows this very well, that I've always advocated that it's around the operations of these diversions. That's where you have to build some trust and some compromise, and not everybody is going to win. And what do I mean by that? I mean that, historically, the river, yes, flooded the wetlands, but only flooded it at flood stage of the river. And we always have had this concept called the flood pulse. In other words, we know right now, you've got high river stage that you're concerned with in New Orleans, right? They're discussing that about whether they're going to you know, how they're going to deal with the flood stage that they're dealing with. That flood stage is exactly when you want to open the diversion and let it nourish the wetlands. And then when the river subsides to its low stages, you turn it off. Now, the beauty of that is that the high river stage is normally in the winter, and the low stage is getting into the spring and the summer when you turn it off, the fisheries and the saltwater species and the saltwater moves back in. So you get this rhythm of the river in the winter and spring at a high stage, and then at the low stage you get the marine sort of occupies the basins. And is there a way we can compromise, you know, that kind of rhythm that you know, brings in the sediment but also allows, you know, some of the marine fisheries that are of such concern. Mm-hmm. There's still going to be winners and losers. You're not going to get all the sediment that you want. There's folks going to feel like they're going to win. They're going to lose on that. Moving up north because it's getting saltier. But you're going to move. They're going to have to move and consolidate a little bit down lower in the basin. Mm-hmm. So they're going to feel like they've lost. But look, they still have got their oyster reefs in the lower basin. So, you know, operations is the key. And that's just been something we just have not been able to sit at the table and figure that out.
In preparing for this, Professor, I came across this article about sewage assimilation, where we're putting treated sewage water into the wetlands. There's a lot of sort of disharmony about how effective that is versus how not effective it is. It's sort of politically fraught. What's kind of your top line reaction to that?
Yeah, I read that report and analysis, and first of all, you know, the use of wetlands. I was a graduate student at the University of Florida, and we were very much involved in research projects back then on the use of wetlands for sewage effluent. So it's a practice that's been around for a long time. I'm not a young chicken anymore, trust me, and I've been around for a long time, and so it's a very well-established practice. There's an industry that engineering manuals, engineering practices. There are wastewater treatment wetlands all over particularly in the southeast. But they were first, actually, some of the first treatment wetlands were up in Michigan. And that's where some of the first applications were actually developed. So I just, first of all, it's not just a Louisiana thing. This has been a practice all over the southeast, very well-established. Second is that in the cases that I've seen in Louisiana is whether it's the new, I don't think it's the nutrients that is the problems. If there's a situation, the loading rates just aren't outlandish related to what wetlands in other states have accommodated, but sometimes the hydro period. So you got to put what, right? You're putting effluent and water into these wetlands, and you got to make sure that the hydro period, what I mean by hydro period, is the duration that the water is, you know, they are wet lands, right? They're lands that are wet, but believe it or not, if you have water and they're wet for too long, it can be a problem. So controlling that water level, sometimes I wonder whether, you know, those are the real issues and it's not the nutrients, but it takes a lot more. I have not looked at the data sufficiently, but I will just say that nutrients and wetlands and that technology has been around for a long time and well tested.
I would like to take a break here real quick, Professor, if you can stick around about another 10 minutes.
Sure.
Superb. If you got a question you want to ask my guest, Robert Twilley, you can shoot it to me right now on the Okunar Jewelers talk and text line. I'll read those texts when I come back. And I also want to talk a little bit more about, there's critics who say that projects like this are too expensive. You heard the governor say a couple weeks ago, hey, we're going to kind of slow all this down because we simply cannot afford it. Well, maybe when we come back, we can talk about what we really cannot afford and what happens if we don't figure this out and quick. I'm Ian Hokin for Scoot. Be right back.
Hi, my name is Lloyd Lockridge, and I'm the host of a new podcast from Odyssey called Family Lore. In this podcast, I'm going to have people on to tell unusual and sometimes far-fetched stories about their families.
I've heard my whole life that she invented the margarita.
And then we're going to investigate those stories and find out how much of it is true.
He gets a patent 1 month before the Wright brothers. Oh my God.
Please follow and listen to Family Lore, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.
After this, I'll remind you that the WWL Jazz Fest code word of the day is culture, C-U-L-T-U-R-E. Go to WWL.com/contest. Enter that code word for your chance to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest. On the line with me still is Professor Robert Twilley from LSU. Thank you, sir, for sticking around. I have a sort of broader questions about, you know, sort of existential crisis that we find ourselves in. But my listeners are sending in some really great questions here. Here's a text that says, does your guest know why Lake Pontchartrain seems to be getting lower, Lake Maurepas as well? Any idea what they're talking about there?
No, I don't. I know that there's a diversion going to Lake Maurepas that will certainly help with some of the nourishment that area needs so much. But I'm surprised that the water levels are dropping in Lake Pontchartrain. I don't know whether that's a seasonal phenomena or whether I'm not aware of any annual or long-term, you know, lowering of the river, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's seasonal. You know, we get these strong winds from the southeast and then from the north, and you can see some pretty drastic changes in water levels in a lake like Pontchartrain with those shifts in the fronts that come through. But I'm not aware of sort of decrease in elevation.
Great. I'm satisfied. Oceanography. Turns out it's complicated, right? Here's a text that says, it would be nice if it was very simple. A couple of people are asking about mangroves. Here's a text that says, ask if we replant black mangroves to create land and coastal protection. Another one says, ask about mangroves. They grow in salt water. Can we use them to protect the wetlands?
Wow, great question. I did my PhD on mangroves.
Hey, cool.
And I did it on black mangroves.
Well, I'm glad we got you. Tell us everything you know.
Yeah, well, that I promise I did not send that text. That's not mine.
Sure, Professor.
They are a subtropical plant, warm temperate subtropical plant. They are very limited by the frequency of frost, they've been slowly migrating up the Florida coast and into Louisiana, into Texas. And to be honest, it is a great stabilizer of the shorelines. They have a root system. We call it a radial root system. And what that means is that each tree has a lot of different roots that shoot out from it at long distances, and they have these little pencil structures that stick up out of the ground, and each of those has a root system associated with it. My point being, they can stabilize the soil much better than sophomores can, and so as far as the geotechnical stability of a wetland area relative, say, a hurricane storm surge, I want a black mangrove there. That's the perfect plant. So they are migrating on their own. They have a tremendous ability to migrate on their own, but I know there's a lot of planting. They do need salt water, so you need to keep them, you know, in salt water areas or brackish areas if you're going to plant. And the propagules are very hardy, and they, you know, so it's very positive. I think it's a very positive change in our coastline here in Louisiana. Now, it represents us getting warmer, but, you know, there you go, pluses and minuses.
Yeah, all things in moderation, I suppose. All right, now, fixing the coast is complicated. It's politically fraught. It's an emotional issue for many people, and it's also crazy expensive. So this is going to be maybe the most difficult thing that we will ever be asked to do as a community, as a state, right?
Yep, without a doubt.
And I know scientists don't like to, sometimes, I don't want to overgeneralize, sometimes don't like to answer questions like this. But if we do nothing, either because of just political inertia or something else. What does the midterm future look like for South Louisiana?
Well, you know, I think the do-nothing scenario has been one of the most profound analysis in relative to Louisiana than, say, I've done at other coastal areas, because we have such a high subsidence rate. You know, that's the natural sinking of our landscape, and it's just typical of deltas because we have that soft sediment that's squeezing under the pressure and as a result sinks. And so, you know, that puts us in a situation where it amplifies the decisions that we make. And what I mean there is if we do nothing, that rate of subsidence is actually, you know, three times the rate, in some cases, 2 to 3 times the rate of sea level rise. In fact, I've heard scientists say that it will be 50 years before sea level rise is equal to subsidence in Louisiana. So we're vulnerable to the decisions that we make. And you've seen it. People know in their lifetime what they've seen as far as changes in their coastal communities, right? Go to Leeville, right? Talk to people in Leeville, right? I mean, they saw a huge wetland area when they were kids, and it's all gone. And so when you make decisions on the river and you make decisions relative to how a delta works, it shows up pretty quick. And with the accelerating sea level rise, you know, that plus our subsidence, then the consequences are, yeah, they're profound. And, you know, the only way, if you want to see what your future looks like, I would say drive down to Terrebonne and ride around the Morganza to the Gulf levee system. And that will show you what it's like. And those people had to tax themselves to build protection, right, for them to survive. And so it gets to a point where it's survival. And you know, different areas will see it before others. Terrebonne has seen it quicker than most other areas, and they've had to respond and they've had to protect themselves.
Just a few moments left here, but I would love to end on a happier note. You know, what makes you hopeful about all this?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, and I do think that I get hopeful actually in some respects when I go down to Terrebonne and see the response and see what they've tried to do to build both with nature and with the fact that they've got to protect themselves. You know, and I do think that the using the river, I'm hoping, is not off the table completely. It's expensive. Yeah. The consequences, though, are profound. And I think we have not been at the table on this, using operations as a means of compromise. And I still hold out that we will make some tough decisions because they're really critical for basins like Barataria. I keep working at it.
Keep doing it. We love it. Thank you for your time, your work, and your way, Professor.
Appreciate it.
Really appreciate you making time to be a part of the show today. Really, really well done. Let's step away and get another look at traffic and kind of consider what our future looks like, knowing what we know about the coastline and about the government and about our own sort of vested interests. We have a lot of work to do, folks. We have to walk and chew gum. Let's do it. I'm Ian Hoken for Scoot on WWL. I'll be right back.
Life can feel overwhelming, but on my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Braithen, we're in it together. Every Friday brings you a new story. Listen to From the Heart with Rachel Braithen wherever you get your podcasts.